Welcome back to Agile for All's Humanizing Work Show. I'm Richard Lawrence.
And I'm Peter Green.
This episode, we are looking at the question of why now? What conditions in the world make this the time for the humanizing work movement? So, Peter, I'm going to throw that question over to you. We're figuring this out as we talk about it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So why now from your perspective?
Yeah, so when I think about big picture trends, I think that there are a lot of things today that are different than they were 100 years ago. And a lot of how we organize and structure and think about business is really crystallized, you know, from the 1910s with the scientific management movement, and they focus on efficiency and producing the same thing over and over and over again reliably, and as much of that as possible. That's what most of our organizations were built to do, most of our management structures, and thinking about what management means is built to optimize that. I think the thing that's changed is technology has made things move much more quickly. Technology has caused things to be much more interconnected, to where I can hire somebody to work on a project that I'm interested in today that happens to live across the globe and get the results, the work results from them tomorrow morning. That has never been the case in human history. And so I think the speed of change is one factor. And then related to that is everything's connected in a way that it hasn't been before, which causes things to be a little less predictable, right? There are just too many moving parts for us to keep in mind at any one time, what we often refer to as complexity, right? So speed of change and complexity, I think, are the two factors that are really unique to our day that are saying, you know what, we need to think differently. We're not building machines to mass produce something more efficiently. We are engaging humans to creatively come up with new ideas, to focus on empathy for the customer and really meeting core needs of customers. That's a little different than can I build more or can I deliver more coal efficiently?
So essentially, we've reached the limits of what you can do with industrial scientific management?
Yeah, and I would point out that there are a lot of people in our field that like to bash Frederick Taylor and that whole idea of mechanizing things and focusing on efficiency. I think we should acknowledge that without that work, we would not be where we are today in the world. There would be a much lower level of prosperity. It's demonstrably more efficient, demonstrably more productive. It has led more people to not be hungry than ever before. So I think we should acknowledge the gift that was given to us and, like you said, recognize that we're probably starting to max that out or probably already have maxed that out. Now we need a shift to something different.
This reminds me of what we talk about with individual growth and development, where you run into the limits of what's been working for you.
Yes.
And at that point, it's really easy to say, well, that thing was all bad.
Right, right.
When it's the thing that got you to the place where you could outgrow it.
Yeah, and we talk a lot about that when we talk about, for example, Frederick Laloux's book, Reinventing Organizations. That's one of the core themes of his book is that there are styles of organization that are fit for their day, and they tend to create a certain set of problems in order to solve the old problems. They create new problems, and then the next wave of thinking about how we organize emerges to address the new problems created by that context. So yeah, that idea of stage development at the individual level, I think absolutely plays out here as well.
So I think we've had something of a blip in history where we were able to treat people as machines for a period of time.
Right.
And it in some sense worked.
Yeah.
It created a lot of growth in economies.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And created a lot of prosperity.
Right.
But we bumped up against the limits of it.
Yeah.
And I think of that as a blip in history because I think there was a time before that where work was more human in a lot of ways, where the craftsperson would know the people they were working with
right.
and for,
yeah.
know their suppliers.
Know their customers.
Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right. And then scale.
Right.
And mass industrialization changed that. And then the world became more complex around us, and that's not really working to solve the new problems we need to solve. So we need new ways, but we also probably need to rediscover some old ways.
Yeah, I think humanizing work maybe is a restoration of those principles and thinking about how work worked then, but reapplied to today, because we do have other things that are unique in the world today. And I think global awareness of what's going on in the world is pretty unique to today. If you think of generations, the current generation is much more aware, much more aware of what's going on in the world, much more kind of engaged in wanting to make the world a better place. I think that that's relatively new on the large scale of things, where younger generations really want to be involved and active
engaged.
Yeah. So.
Now, this is interesting as an intellectual discussion, and
yes.
you and I enjoy talking about that, but I want to make it practical.
Okay.
So what?
Yeah, so what? I think so. And I think one of the things that we know when we look at things like complexity, we're both big fans of David Snowden's work around complexity. No relation to the other Snowden, for those of you watching. But David Snowden's work around complexity, where he really teases apart work that is complicated, meaning it's predictable, but you do have to really dig in and analyze and come up with a good plan, apply your expertise in order to kind of predict what the right thing to do is, versus things that are complex. And there are other domains to that model, the Kanevan model, but those are the two that we tend to play in most often when we're working with organizations. This difference between complicated and complex, meaning that you really can't predict up front, the right answer emerges through experiments. So from a practical standpoint, viewing work as a series of experiments versus viewing work as a process that needs to be optimized is something I think is very practical and seems to give huge benefit to a lot of our clients.
And if your work is that complex, experiment-oriented work, you need to engage people in a different way.
Right.
And so I think those humanizing work themes that we talked about,
right.
Creativity, collaboration, impact, growth, become really important.
Right.
If you don't pay attention to those things, you're not likely to succeed there.
Yeah, I think frankly, for the previous century, you could be very successful completely ignoring all of those factors. And you know, in another episode, we talked about some of the motivation factors. And one of the things that most of those authors are talking about is that in order to do mechanistic work, where I'm shoveling coal or I'm turning a crank, the theory X approach, where you just financially incent people to do it the way you want them to, actually works. It actually works. You do get better outputs from that. It ceases to work as soon as the context of the work becomes creative problem solving and you need to generate new ideas and new ways of doing things. That's where they see it actually, that theory X approach to things actually has a negative impact on whatever we're trying to accomplish.
Mm. The other so what that comes to mind for me is if you're somebody sitting in the middle of an industrial era organization, and you want to think about how do I make the case for things being differently being organized differently.
Yeah,
I think the increased complexity in the world, the increased speed of change, is a business reason to start thinking about humanizing work.
It's difficult, I think, because a lot of the negative impacts of taking a more mechanistic view are long term. And so many, especially publicly held corporations in the United States and other Western countries like this, have a legal incentive to maximize this quarter's revenue. That's the way they interpret the legal rules, the bylaws of a corporation as maximizing shareholder value. That does create an incentive around how do we drive stock price up this quarter for a publicly held company. And most of the large companies in the world that set the tone for how we should run businesses and the case studies are around those types of companies where there's incented to maximize a little bit and to squeeze everything out of what we can for the next quarter so that the stock price will go up. So it is a challenge even for somebody in one of those organizations to fight against that. And frankly, it's a challenge for the CEO in that organization who might have a deeply held belief that we should have a more engaged workforce that's collaborating more effectively. And he or she is battling the external force of Wall Street's going to respond this way. I've got to drive the price up. I've got to do this. And they are the ones, I think, that are really caught in the middle of that battle is the top leaders in a lot of organizations where, despite their deeply held principles and beliefs, they feel like they've got to do something to drive that price up and to increase the quarterly revenue and those kind of things. So it's a challenge.
One thing I've seen leaders do to respond to that is to kind of separate off the innovative, experimental, skunk works part of the business.
Uh-huh.
And so we're going to experiment with new ways of working over here.
Yeah.
And we're going to maintain our cash cow part of the business,
uh-huh.
the thing that has continued to work.
Yeah.
And as long as you keep those sufficiently separate that the old part doesn't co-opt the new part, you can get some of the benefits of the lower risk, sustain your business without changing it, and the higher risk, more experimental.
Yeah.
Let's respond to complexity better. And then as that works, you can expand it.
I think that's the theory that a lot of leaders have going into that approach. I've also seen real challenges in the second part of that, in that maybe then that can spread.
Yeah.
We've got it working here, and how do we spread it over here? So I've seen some challenges in that. And to me, that feels like a safe strategy. And they're not only siloing off the innovation R&D group, they're also siloing off things like engagement. Like, that's HR's job to figure out how to drive engagement up. So I do think that that's a pretty safe strategy. What gets me excited are organizations that have just thrown it all out and said, what's a better way of doing this? Because the cool thing about this is that you can get the financial benefits by focusing on the humanizing work aspect as the core guiding principle versus, well, this is something we're gonna try and staple on to our cash cow approach to doing business and our KPIs and our more mechanistic view of an organization. And so I get really excited when I hear about organizations that are very successful in their field who took a humanizing work approach from the core principle, or a leader that came in to a more mechanistic organization and said, you know what, I just believe this is the wrong way to run an organization. I'm gonna chip away at every single process, every single structure that seems to be in conflict with those humanizing work principles. And over the course of years, they completely transform it into an organization. You know, when I share these case studies in classes and with clients, people will read the case study and literally they'll say, this is made up, right? This isn't really, I don't believe it. Because it seems so crazy to them. It seems so different from how almost every organization in the world functions and every organization that they've experienced. I noticed that one of the core principles for each of those leaders when they found those companies or when they transform them that way is this principle that I actually trust other humans to do the right thing, given purpose, autonomy, and mastery. They will use it the right way if those things are all clear to them. And that seems to be a sticking point for a lot of leaders is, do I actually believe that human beings will behave this way if I don't have the controls around it? So that seems to be one of the sticking points. And the leaders that have been effective there, for whatever reason, whether that's a stage of development, whether that's just experiences after experiences, or they're just some unicorn type leader, for whatever reason, they just believe that at their core. And they just chip away at anything that conflicts with that.
So, Peter, are you then telling people they just need to go find one of these leaders that's willing to bet the company to change everything?
Yeah, that would be nice, right? I found a couple dozen examples like that in the world. So yeah, just go find one of those companies sprinkled throughout the world.
But you have to find them before they do it, right?
Yeah, or you know, you can find them in the midst of it, right? Okay. There are some companies out there that are fully functioning this way. But no, that's not my advice. I think my advice would be that those leaders take a particular approach to it, which is a corely held belief. And then they chip away at anything that conflicts with that corely held belief. Now, I think any leader at any level in any organization can do that. And I think any individual on a team can do that. The challenge, I think, or the flow through that is that you start with, what do I actually believe about how humans work together? And get really clear on that. Do I really believe this? And can I test that belief? And you could think of each of these leaders' organizations as a series of tests to say, well, what if I give them this freedom? What if I give the responsibility for this? How would that work? Going back into that realm of complexity where we test the system and see what emerges, each of those leaders took that approach, testing these beliefs. And I think any individual can do that. So somebody on a team could do that to say, I really believe that if we took this control off as within the team, and just trusted each other to do the right thing, assuming that there was transparency and accountability in place to balance that we would get better results. Try that. Make that a retrospective topic. What control could we remove? And what would we need to replace that control with in order to be successful? So I think anybody can try that. Try an experiment. Make it time-bounded for 2 weeks on what do you really believe, and how could you test that in the context of your work tomorrow? I think that would be my advice.
Yeah, that's much more practical.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good. Well, thanks for joining us. As usual, we want to hear from you in the comments. Let us know how complexity and speed have affected you and your organization and what you're trying to handle it.
And I would add to that, if you're aware, as you might have gathered from this, I get excited about these inspirational examples of humanizing work in play in organizations. If you're aware of other companies or organizations that are really taking that, what feels like a radical approach to humanizing work in the workplace, we would love to hear about it in the comments. We want to reach out to these companies. We want to talk to the leaders and the people that work there to see what we can learn from them.
See you next time.